The Jersey Grays. What were these guys from Jersey doing in New York State during the American Revolution? This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. Phil Weaver joins us. Phil, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Bob. Nice to talk to you again.
Phil Weaver has been an active living historian for over 40 years, a highly regarded tailor, presenter, and independent researcher. Phil has written articles on the colonial period and living history for national publications. He operates Continental Consulting, based in Highland, New York, I believe, in the Hudson Valley, providing books and used reproduction period clothing and other items for the history community. And Phil Weaver is author of the new book, The Third New Jersey in New York, Stories from the Jersey Grays of 1776. Let me go back to our lead-in question here, Phil. What were these guys from Jersey doing in New York State?
Well, I can give you kind of a smart aleck answer real quick. They were basically starting out in New York City, and they were passing through on a nice little boat ride up to Albany, and then they were going to make a little fun-filled trip up to Canada to fight the British. But they got diverted in Albany for Johnstown. And as I say, they ended up enjoying the winter sports at Ticonderoga in Lake Champlain for the winter of 76 and 77. And of course, that's a short answer. So, we can get more detail, obviously. But.
Sure. So they spent 1776 in New York State. Could tell us about the origin of this regiment. They're from New Jersey, right?
Right. Well, you got one of the root things people have to learn when you're talking about Continental Army regiments is there were different establishments throughout the war. There were, in 1775, there were a lot of militia regiments up in New England after Lexington Concord for Bunker Hill. They were starting to draw them up there. And then New York had Continental regiments. They were uniform, but they were for the province. And then also Connecticut had Continental regiments. They weren't uniformed, but so there was a number of Connecticut regiments. But once the Canadian campaign fell apart, which it did on Christmas of 75, they started things started going bad in Canada, so they had to beef it up. So they started the second establishment of the army in January of 1776, and then all the militia regiments were formed into Continental regiments, and then the they weren't states at the time, they were colonies. The Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York again started recruiting more regiments, and they had two things to worry about. The Brits were leaving New England. They were going to leave in March to go up to Nova Scotia, but then they kind of thought they were going to come back and try to take New York, which they were. So New Jersey put up two regiments initially, the first and second, and they were sent north into Canada. And then they decided we need another one, so they recruited a third one a little bit later in the year, like March. I forget the date because the dates tend to be muddled around there. But they started relatively early, but by the time they got them going was March, and they initially were to go into New York City. So they worked their way across New Jersey in the old F&I war barracks. F&I is French Indian War. They used these old barracks as stagings, and they would recruit and work their way across and get into Perth Amboy area, and then they would cross into New York City, and that's where they were mustered in, into the Continental Army. And they were initially supposed to be part of the defense force, because New York didn't have anybody in New York City. So that's what they were supposed to be. But then they said, well, Canada's folding up. We need to send more regiments north. So they were signed with John Sullivan to go north, and they went on Hudson River sloops. They went north. And that's where they were headed.
Didn't, when they were in New York City, didn't they impress George Washington or something like that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. When they were in review, they were claimed to be the completest with an EA, the completest regiment in the Continental Army. Now, you got to remember, at that time, they were the only regiment that they had seen in regimental uniforms. So they were very impressive. They had the tan coat, gray goes, that's where the name grays come from, and with blue lapels, so they weren't blue, they were tan uniforms, and they're marching around with leather breeches, and they look very impressive, white trimmed cocked hats. So they looked very, so they, of course, they get praised a lot. They were really good. So they said, we need them here. But then again, they wanted to get rid of them, because then they decided to get rid of them. Then they said, well, why do we send them? And they get into this yin and yang of keeping them, letting them go, not wanting them, wanting them back throughout their entire service. So they were heading north. But Schuyler, when they got up to Major General Schuyler, he said, well, wait a minute, we really need them out here, because I got a problem with John Johnson out of Johnstown and Johnson Hall. He was a leading loyalist. We don't trust him. We got to get to him and stop him.
Yeah, so, and they were afraid he was going to flee to Canada and come back and harass the Mohawk Valley, which is what he did. So what did the Jersey Greys do or try to do about that?
Well, they were, when they got to Albany, they decided, well, let's send some of the guys out. So they sent an initial force out there. That was their plan. They went right to Johnson Hall. That was their, they were looking for him, but he had already left. Because you got to think back. I don't go into this in the book, but it's in Norm, our friend Norm Boland's book actually goes into this in some detail. They were out there in 75, and a lot of troops were out there, and Johnson had promised he wasn't going to cause any trouble. He wasn't going to work with the Indians. He wasn't going to do anything. But then they got wind he was doing it anyway. So that's why they went out. And when they got there, he had just left. And he had taken his Highlanders with him. And because he had a bunch of Highlanders he brought in from Scotland that were his loyalists, his favorite people. And they all left. So they said, well, now we're here. He's coming back. Let's get the rest of the regiment out here. So they pulled the rest of them to the west, and the whole regiment was out in the Mohawk Valley for the rest of the spring, summer, and early fall.
Yep. And did they not capture Mrs. Johnson? I mean, she was still there, right?
Or somebody captured. Lady Johnson was still there, and they had to kind of scope her out for her. So one of the officers, Captain Joseph Bloomfield, who became the lead captain and eventually the major of the regiment, he was a pretty sharp cookie, and he wrote a beautiful diary of his, a journal of his account. So it's one of the nucleuses of the book. And when Bloomfield goes to see Lady Johnson, he does it on a pretest to see one of her, I forget, her niece or something, and he had a pretest to go to see her. He kind of knew she wasn't there, but he went anyway so he can check her out. And they kind of started talking, and they developed a very good relationship. So there was a floating argument with Schuyler in Washington where they should leave her there or put her in confinement. They finally decided that let's send her to Albany. So, of course, she wasn't happy about that, but she did go, and they took her. But only Bloomfield escorted her, and she took a servant, her two or three kids, and who went with her is kind of a vague story. There's different accounts on who went with her, but there was a servant and probably a midwife of some type, or a governess is the word. Mm-hmm. And they took her back to Albany. And this is when one of the stories, when I talk about this being a storybook, this is one of the stories, is he is escorting her to Albany, and when he gets probably near Schenectady, he's accosted Bloomfield and Lady Johnson. Now, her stagecoach, whatever she was in, her carriage, kept going to Albany, but Bloomfield gets accosted by these loyalists, and they start claiming his horse belonged to somebody, was confiscated, and it's almost like a mob. And he's getting ready to fight these guys. He's got pistols and stuff, but he's on a horse by himself, and he's got about 15 guys around him. So this is a hairy situation. And out of the blue, a fellow by the name of Henry Deffendorf steps out, almost like right out of an Errol Flynn movie. All right, I'm going to stand and fight with him. And he draws his sword. All of a sudden, they got two guys now. So the loyalists break up and go off. And Henry Deffendorf apparently goes back with him, because he's one of the other officers whose diary is an account, who's actually Bloomfield's second lieutenant, was in Albany, and he says, you know, Bloomfield came back in with another officer. And this was apparently Henry Deffendorf, who was actually from the Mohawk Valley. I believe he was born in Minden, and I did an article for him in the Journal of the American Revolution. And he's a very interesting man, and he apparently was doing some counter-espionage work. So it's kind of an interesting little sidebar story.
Yeah, well, quite a story so far. So eventually Mrs. Johnson goes to Albany. She's held by the rebels for a long time, but she eventually gets back to Johnson, doesn't she, up in Canada?
Right. That's actually true. You read it very well. It's exactly what happened. She's in Albany, and she tries to lobby to get out, and they're not going to let her out of Albany because they always have a feeling there's a lot of lack of trust, so they don't know what she's going to do, and she's got kids and stuff, but they don't trust her. The powers that be, Washington, they really don't know. But then Washington kind of begs off and leaves it up to Schuyler. And eventually, and then the local committees, and there's a whole big thing about what the committees are. I won't take up any time now. I can get long. But the various political committees and extra-legal bodies in the colony of New York decide, well, let's let her go. Well, we said, we'll let her go to Fishkill. And that's where she went. Now, Fishkill, I believe, is where one of the other committees, the New York Convention, I believe, which was the new legal body that took over for the Provincial Congress when New York became a state, they were in Albany and in Fishkill, so that's where she went. And she is in a place called Fishkill Landing, which is now Beacon, which is the eastern end of the Newburgh Beacon Bridge, down my way down here. It kind of loses a story, and actually, thanks to our friend Gavin Watt from Canada, he had a book that was written about this and had some detailed information. She apparently went over to the Coldenham Mansion. Cadwallader Colden was the son of a leading loyalist who had just passed away, and he had built this mansion in, I say Coldenham, it's in Coldenham area now. It's the Colden Mansion, and that's where she stayed. And by now it's winter. And apparently she was pregnant, but I don't have any real source on it. So that's why there was a lot of delays in her going, because she was taken over there in June. It's now December. And she's over and across the river, on my side of the river, in Lower Ulster County, which is now part of Orange. And she sneaks out and on a sled, and she heads south and gets down to Perth Amboy. Now, meanwhile, John Johnson has gone to Canada, and he has already made his way to New York. So he's in New York City, and he comes over and gets her in Perth Amboy, which is right across the river. So that's how they do it. And what's interesting is they get word of Johnson leaving from a sergeant with the 3rd Jersey who was captured on a patrol. And when he is paroled, he brings back word that Johnson has left. So it all kind of circles around. and it's the story about what happens on the patrol. That's also in the book.
All right. And, of course, John Johnson causes a lot of trouble for the patriots or the rebels all through the rest of the revolution, coming down, leading raids and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. But that's not part of this story, which is, there's enough here to 1 year.
Well, some of the Jersey Greys stayed at Johnson Hall. Is it so that they ransacked the place? Is that so or not so?
Oh, that's absolutely true. They were, the Jerseys were in an area called German Flats, which is indifferent than where it is now. There seems to be it's on either side of the river. It's kind of convoluted. But they're in German Flats. They built a place called Fort Dayton. They're up at Fort Stanwix, or what they renamed Fort Schuyler, where that gets into the confusion, which they call the different names. But what we call locally, because the National Park is there, Fort Stanwix. So that's where they were. And then they were also at Johnson Hall. And what happened, apparently, is somebody got a little drunk. There's no proof. And then some of the officers decided, let's go inside. Now, they were specifically ordered not to go in that house, because this was after Lady Johnson left, but they wanted to get their stuff, and I think alcohol had a lot to do with it. And they went in, and they basically broke in, and they gutted the place of all the artifacts, all the stuff, all his trophies and his gifts from the Indians, and Indian leggings and deer hides and clothing and cutlery and crockery and all this stuff. They took it all out of there, and unfortunately, I can't get into details about a lot of the legal stuff, but I do cover what happens briefly with these guys. And they end up saying, Colonel Dayton is very upset. And it seems to lead from Lieutenant Colonel White, who was the second in command. He seems to have been the prompter to do it. But they don't really prove it, but he kind of was the guy who started all this. And alcohol has a lot to do with it, because they actually break in the wine cellar and get a little more alcohol. You know, if you've ever done any elbow bending, I have. The more you drink, the more you want. And never go shopping when you're drunk. So,
but the revolutionary cause did not, the higher-ups didn't want them to ransack the building.
Oh, no, they didn't want to go. Ransack wasn't even close. They didn't want anybody even in the house. And they had all, and Dayton had basically sworn this, promised this wasn't going to happen, Colonel Dayton. So he's beside himself. So they said, all right, all is forgiven. You got to get all the stuff back. So they got most of it back, but some of the pieces didn't quite get it. And they end up finding one guy who wouldn't give the stuff back, one second lieutenant, and named McDonald. Might have been a first lieutenant, I forget. But McDonald did not want to give up the stuff. So he got to be the token scapegoat. As they say, they always have a scapegoat. He was it.
Right. And we're talking with Phil Weaver, who's the author of the book, The Third New Jersey in New York, Stories from the Jersey Grays of 1776. We'll be back with Phil in just a moment. Do want to mention that the Historians podcast continues because of your donations to our GoFundMe campaign. You can find the link to the GoFundMe page on our homepage, which is bobcudmore.com. And if you feel you can afford it, make a small donation to our fundraising effort. Or you can send a check made out to me, Bob Cudmore, to 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. And thank you very much. Phil Weaver, author of The Third New Jersey in New York, Stories from the Jersey Grays of 1776. Time is fleeting here, Phil. We got to get these guys up to Fort Ticonderoga. They were in the Mohawk Valley, up around Johnson Hall and other places. Why is it they went to the area of Fort Ticonderoga farther north?
Well, they have to... The Northern Army was split between two commands, and I get into it briefly in the book. There's between Major General Gates and Major General Schuyler. This is the only department in the Continental Army that there's two major generals. So it's an interesting dichotomy, and it's one of the great things I talk about in the book. But ultimately, to keep it short, Schuyler gives up control and allows these guys to go up to Fort Ticonderoga area, because Ticonderoga is where the Northern Army, it was then called the Canadian Army, came back down after losing Canada. Everybody's there, but it's the end of the year. They have, in 76, the year's almost done. The 3rd Jersey, because it was recruited late, is still an active regiment. So they're still part of the Army, so all these other units are leaving. So they say, well, let's send it. And the 1st and 2nd of Jersey were done. They were going back. So they said, let's send the 3rd up here. And that's where they went initially. And then ultimately they left Ticonderoga after about 2 months, and they went over to Mount Independence over on the Vermont side. And that's where they spent the winter. The remainder of the winter was over at Mount Independence. So in this area, you know, this is the northern end of New York at the time. This was it. So, and they spent the winter out there. And it got a little crisp and cold, and they just had to survive. And as regiment after regiment after regiment were leaving.
Were they there for the Battle of Valcour Island on Lake Champlain?
No, they got there. I'm out of time to get my timing. They didn't go until October. They didn't get there until November 1st. So Valcour Island had already happened.
Okay.
So the thing was, the Valcour Island, they stopped. The Valcour Island stopped it, so the Brits weren't coming down. So that's why these other units decided to bail out. In fact, Major General Gates decided to leave too. So that's when everything fell to Colonel Anthony Wayne, who was kind of the senior colonel there, and Dayton wasn't there very long. He left too with the 3rd Jersey. So Wayne ends up being the commander. And Wayne's, and we get into some of the story, I get into some stories with Dayton. I'm sorry, with Wayne. And Wayne is, the jerseys don't like him because he has a bug up his backside about the third jersey and is never explained, but I think it has rooted back to the plundering of Johnson Hall. So it all kind of ties together. But Wayne is always needling these guys and being a nuisance with them. And he likes to instigate trouble, and he did a couple of times. And I say time is short, so I don't want to get into all these things that go on up there. But Lieutenant Elmore, who was Bloomfield's second lieutenant, also has this diary. When he hears that Anthony Wayne was made a Brigadier General, he goes, I hear Colonel Wayne was made a Brigadier General. At first, I thought it was a joke. You know, really the phraseology he uses. And it's quite fun, all the little different things that happen. Sure. But they are freezing their asses off, to be honest with you, up there.
Right. But eventually, they go back to New Jersey in 1777, right?
Right. They go back because their enlistment is a year. So what's interesting, when they're ready to go back home, they say, well, can you stay a little bit longer? And these guys, what's left of them, because there's a lot of attrition. Through attrition, the size of the regiment is reduced because these guys have been getting sick and they've been sending them south to Albany. So finally they said, well, you know what? We'll stay. So he stayed several weeks longer until finally other troops started coming in. So then they headed south and they went down. They described right in detail what was their route going back into Albany. And they're basically covering, I'm trying to think, I was going to say 60, but that seems high. It might be 30 miles a day. They do a good chunk. They go down to Fort Inn. Then they go over and they work their way down, all the way down into Albany. And then they continue down to Kingston, and then they cross they go into the Roundout River, and then they pick up the Walk Hill, and which then Roundout was a creek, and the Walk Hill was also a creek, because Kill is creek. And that actually goes right by my hometown, which is quite fun. They actually go right New Falls, where I grew up. And they go down, and then they get off, and they take the Ramapo Pass down to back into Jersey. And they get mustered out at Morristown.
Now, again, we have a few minutes left. The book is out now. How much does the book cost? How can we order it?
Yeah, we're in limbo right now. It should be out as we're timing. It will be out in, it'll be $21.95. It will be available on Amazon. I don't have all the details yet, and I'm going to have it through my website at Continental Consulting, and you can get it there. It's old school. You've got to order a check, but drop me an email at phil@conconsult.com, and you'll get it for $20. I am asking us New Yorkers that you chip in a little bit more to help pick up the sales tax. You don't have to, but I'll discount it to $20.
So let me direct folks to your website. It's content. What is the website?
It's conconsult.com. It's conconsul.com.
Okay. And Phil Weaver joins us. The book is The Third New Jersey in New York, Stories from the Jersey Greys of 1776. I've known Phil now over the years where you've been at the Fort Plain Museum's American Revolution conferences. What is it that you do? I introduced you, but what is it that Continental Consulting does?
Well, Continental Consulting was a business that I originally started as I left leadership positions in the living history world, I decided we needed a newsletter, some type of a magazine. I wanted to do something different. I could go back in the ranks, and I did that, but I wanted to do something else. I decided to start this newsletter. And it had good success. It was a cult, but it didn't really take off. So that's what I did was I needed to start a business, a DBA account that I could run both. So Continental Consulting was the business that ran the newsletter called the Colonial Chronicle. And eventually, the newsletter was the main crux of the business. And then I started getting into some books, working with Don Hages, who is now with The Jar. He used to sell books, and I used to pick up some of his books on consignment. And then I started dealing with him on my own, and gradually Don phased out of it, and I took over my end of it. And we started selling books, and then the business expanded as kind of a bookstore. And in between, we'd pick up used articles and things like this.
Right. And when you mentioned JAR, that's the Journal of the American Revolution, right? Yep. But you're also, I notice in your credits, you're a tailor. I mean, you make uniforms for people?
I used to more often than I do now. I've kind of, as time has gone on, I spend more time writing and researching than I do. But I have made clothing. I have won awards for it and stuff. I've designed, in fact, the coat that my recreated regiment wears, I designed it. So I would do pieces on occasion, and I still occasionally do something, but it's pretty rare anymore. But that was my original kind of nucleus.
Maybe this is what you just said, but I believe, looking online, that there is a reenacting group for the 3rd New Jersey. Have you provided stuff for them?
No, I don't stuff for them. They have there's two different versions of the 3rd Jersey. There's the Jersey Blues, which was started by the famous George Newman, famous collector, and he was one of the founders of the Brigadier American Revolution, and the unit that he started within that umbrella group was the 3rd Jersey Blues, and they wore blue uniforms, red lapels, and they still exist. And then, since then, in recent years, a new group has started doing this Jersey Gray unit with the drab color with the blue lapels, and they have their own internal process. And they're around currently. So both units are done. I do 2nd New York for 1775, and I've always done that. And that's actually my core interest. This 3rd Jersey stuff was a sidebar. But because it's actually easier to research, because there's more documentation on it, it's actually easier to do, so better to get the easy stuff done first. In fact, now, Henry Deffendorf is a 2nd New York guy. That's how I love this. So I got Henry Deffendorf and another guy, Lathrop Allen, both ex-2nd New York guys, are in this story. And I got them woven into it.
When you say you do the 2nd New York, you mean you're a reenactor doing that?
Or I don't like to say reenactor. That bothers me. I didn't hold.
I got that impression. I mean, you had a different word.
Well, reenactor
a living
has a
historian.
Negative connotation to it. Yeah, it does. You know, you go back, and we've talked about this before. A reenactor is kind of a guy with wearing baggy pants and funny hat, and he's, you know, smoking a pipe and he's shooting a gun. I don't do that, you know, and I haven't done that in the groups I belong to, except some of the earlier ones. Don't do that. And, you know, when you're wearing coats with hand-stitched lapels, in buttonholes with every stitch knotted, hand-sewn, you know, we block our hats. We use the right material. I don't consider reenacting isn't that. It's living history. It's historical recreation. Other terms you can use. Reenacting has a kind of negative connotation, and that's just a pet peeve of mine. In fact, if you look on my website, on the article section, there is something that it's a very well-known article that people have been copying for years. It was an editorial I did on the whole theory, and you can get my whole pitch on that. But it's I balk at the term, because it's not what it means, it's what it implies. And there is a difference.
So you prefer a living historian?
I prefer a living historian or a historical recreationist. There's different ways you can phrase it. It gets, hey, look, I'm not a politically correct guy, but in this I get politically correct.
Phil Weaver is author of the book, The 3rd New Jersey in New York, Stories from the Jersey Grays of 1776. You can find it through his website, and you can find more information on our website about Phil. You have been listening to the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore.